continuity is an important question for everyone. Start with your own background and how you got into this whole thing to begin with.
Okay. I come from Hartford, Connecticut.
Ah.
Born in Hartford.
Well, that's my turf. Yeah.
Oh, really? And my grandfather, Shalom, was a chazan. And my father was a great lover of chazanim and a great understands what you'd call a real maven.
Mm-hmm.
Has a marvelous voice, but when he came to America, he couldn't afford to become a chazan. He had to go to work. My education was at public school in Hartford, but then when I decided I wanted to become a chazan at a very young age, I think I was like 14 or 15, which was young, I decided I went to yeshiva in Baltimore.
Why Baltimore?
Because that's what I said. Well, I don't know. Why Baltimore? Because it was either that or New York, you know, mm-hmm. for a living place, because Hartford didn't have a high school.
Right.
And so I went to Baltimore and then spent 3 to 4 years there. Then I went to Hart College of Music.
So you came back home.
Came back home. And then through Arthur Corrett's nudging and I guess inspiration. I guess I don't know if it was inspiration, but coaxing. I went to the seminary and I was the first Hartford student to go to the seminary, and I not only studied the seminary, but I studied privately chazanut and with a real old chazan, A.I. Sherman. At that time was like 85 years old, and I was his last student, so carried on a tradition. And my style of chazanus through my upbringing and through my also personal philosophy is very traditional,
mm-hmm.
extremely traditional, which is unfortunately becoming a passe
mm-hmm.
mode in today's living. Fortunately, my congregation either accepts it or they have no choice, because I've been there. You know, I've been there for 15 years now and do have life tenure. One of the few chazanim, by the way, that does have life tenure, and I was given it at.
Really?
At my 10th anniversary, which is very rare. I don't think there's any chazan in America that have got a life tenure at 10 years.
Where are you now?
In Dayton, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
So, I guess what you're probably interested in mostly is my work with the kids, with youth choirs. You want to ask any specific questions, or you just want me to go rambling
on? Go ahead,
on?
Yeah. If,
okay.
How did you get into that
okay.
particular...
Well, it came both as a personal thing and also as a thing which I really felt very, very keenly and very strongly about, even as a student. You know, and everyone finds a niche for themselves, not a niche, I mean a professional, I guess, goal.
Kind of profile, you mean? Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I take great pride in my davening and my singing, and I consider myself a fine singer
mm-hmm.
and a fine chazan. But when I was younger, and by the way, this is not the way it stands now. When I was younger, I looked for something which I could do perhaps better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No matter how great a singer you could be, there's always somebody better.
Yeah.
There's always Tucker, and there was always Pierce, and there was always Kusevitsky. You know, there was always, and if you, no matter how great a chazan you were, you could. And it just so happened, I had this talent,
yeah.
which I discovered even when I was a student, and it began to. I began to feel that I perhaps make my greatest contribution in this. At great personal sacrifice also, because what it meant is that instead of devoting my entire career to my own personal betterment or advancement or whatever, and it came to a point, I'll never forget, I had a discussion with a voice teacher after I graduated, and she said to me, at that time, she said, look, do you want to be a singer? You could be a top singer. You could be first class. Or do you want to be a conductor or a director of children or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
It's a decision you're going to have to make. You'll always be a good singer, but on the other hand, if you go to this, there's no way you're going to be able to excel in both.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason it was, I'm not saying that I was idealist that I was going to, but I did think about it and I figured to myself, and I then it did take thinking, a great amount of thought. That perhaps my contribution would be in this area, because frankly, without, you know, there's not a time to be humble, I guess. I probably did it better than anybody else, or I thought I did. And sure enough, I had this way with kids, which I saw in very few that could. I could take a group of kids when I was in even in the seminary, I had a student post in Nanuet, New York, and the congregation was like 80 families. I had a children's choir, 40 voices. Mm. So, I mean, I was able to mold it, and I did have this personality, I guess, whatever it was, whether it was teacher. I think it was more anything because I believed in it so strongly. See, I have this philosophy with kids that you can get kids to do anything you want them to do, anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I used to bring the choirs to the convention and do our recordings, I'll go into this later, and they say, how'd you do this? My God, the scope of this work, it's not kids' music. And I wrote about this also. I mean, my philosophy is that if you believe in it, then you can get them to believe in it. And I said, any kind of music that I personally can do, they can do. And it worked. There's no question about it. I really got off the board. I really started moving in 1966 when I was in Akron, Ohio, at which at that time I commissioned, and you're the historian, you could document it, but I've documented it myself, the first commissioned work for a children's choir in the American synagogue. Arthur Yelkoff wrote for us a Friday night service called Shirat Atideinu, which had its premiere in Dayton on April 1st, 1966. And I remember this because it was a momentous occasion, I thought, for the history of Jewish music. And it was performed a month later here at the convention, and it was the very, very first time that a children's choir was ever invited to the Kansas Convention. This is 1966, April, and I don't know the date, I think it was April 8th, I think. And we performed this at the Concord Hotel. And although I've gone through many experiences artistically and et cetera, nothing comes close to that. Mm-hmm. When I had a person like David Kusevitsky, who was the, I guess, the peon of Chazanut in America today and then, literally came to me with tears in his eyes after that performance. Mm-hmm. And he said, I must tell you, this was the finest, one of the highlights, one of the finest musical experiences I've had in my entire life. No, maybe the statement was a bit grandiose, but at that moment, I'm sure that's what he felt. Mm-hmm. When he had the entire, I could show you a letter I had from Sam, the entire assemblage was in tears. It was not so much, I don't think, I guess the beauty of the music was something. But I think it renews a faith in the members. I sing, I think about 35 or 40 kids on the stage.
Yeah. Yes, I can see the transmission and continuation are very much in everybody's mind. Right.
And they saw something singing a traditional work.
Yeah.
Beautiful work. But not only that, but seeing kids get up there and sing with a professional skill,
right,
which they thought was, I mean, because it was like something, I don't know how to explain it. It's like, okay, if you come to sessions, you hear great voices, you hear great singers. Okay, you're not surprised because if they're not so great, you're surprised.
Right.
Okay, and even no matter how great they are, you sit and listen. But to have this thunderbolt hit them,
right,
because nothing in the entire time has equaled it. And
right,
as far as a group of 40 kids getting up there and not just singing a thing in unison, but singing at that time, of course, we went beyond this, intricate music in three-part and four-part harmony of an entire fight.
How old were these kids?
They were from age 9 to 15 at that time, right, in which they, without a score in front of them, they did the entire thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes,
well, it was very interesting at that time, as I'll go later on in my career, I'll tell you, go into this in greater depth. They used the score, and when we came to the convention here, I just said, close the books. And they just were shocked, you know. This is the afternoon before, or the day before the performance. And they knew, I knew they knew the thing, right, you know. Because to me, memorization is not a matter of just plugging away. If you work it long enough, you know it whether you want to know it or not. Anyways, we went through the entire score. I said, I knew you knew it by memory, so we're not going to use any music. And I said, first of all, it'll inspire you more because we'll have this contact. I knew you knew the music. And I said, it'll also be much more impressive. So it was an incredible experience.
Sure.
I could show you letters from Sam at that time and also from people who were there that, you know, that it was just a momentous occasion. And I never, truly, and since then I've toured this entire country, and I've toured Israel, and we've gone to England, but never as any moment came like that, because it was the first time. But that started something in my career, which I think is unique, in that I commissioned more music, and not, again, I'm not, this could be documented, especially for kids, than any cantor in the history of the Assembly. Mm-hmm. I think something like over 25 works since 1966. I'm talking about major works. Mm-hmm. And not only but that, but most of these works have been so-called transcribed for adult voices, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really mushroomed. And if you go, as a matter of fact, if you go into the bookstores over here, you'll see the records. And matter of fact, tonight you'll be hearing Jan Pierce is singing, honoring him. You'll hear an expert of a recording of his last performance was with a different group. Anyways, I was in Akron for 6 years, at which time the last 4 years, commissioned every year, it became a tradition to commission a new work for children's choir. And then it began to develop in difficulty, in utilizing the finest talents in Jewish composition, as I felt, as I thought, you know. I have to be honest with you, I never was interested ever in creating an avant-garde, a new sound. I'm a traditionalist in every sense and a point. I guess you would call me a conservative. As a matter of fact, I commissioned a work just for next year, and I wrote the composer. I said, if this is going to please Schoenberg and Boulez, I'm not interested in it. I want kids to walk out of that rehearsal room whistling or tapping their foot or whatever. Because in the very, very beginning, I had an ulterior motive, and that was education.
Right.
This was my way of teaching and educating kids. No aspect of this work met with more difficulty than this philosophy, because rabbis were against it, educators were against it. The whole concept of, and I proved my point with this Friday night service. I said, these kids learned the entire liturgy of the Friday night. And as I called it, education through the back door. They were being taught. Matter of fact, I wrote an article
about.
Sounds
like the front door to me. I mean, what was the objection? What were the objections?
Well, because this it was a non-traditional way of teaching. They felt, the kids, because I made a big fight about this in Akron in mm-hmm. the beginning, that I felt kids should be taken out of class time. I mean, no, it's in the beginning, anyways. After, for rehearsal time, I was able. And once the group developed, I was able to take them when I wanted. But in the beginning, I felt that a half hour out of class is important for these kids,
yeah.
Okay, as the other stuff that they were learning, whatever. Because
that's,
this was to me was an
edge. It seems to me that choirs, that kind of choir, was not a new phenomenon.
It was very new.
I mean, the idea that within a synagogue there'd be
not children,
not kids. Right?
No, not that.
Until the late 60s, really?
No.
Because now I hear about when I ask people, what do you do? And they say, oh, I want a sisterhood thing, I want this, I want a children's, a kids' choir.
Yeah, but you got to understand, it was never at this level. No, there's never been a children's choir that reached, I'm talking about this, I'm still in Akron.
Yeah, yeah. No, okay. But I'm speaking about the concept of having one of the units
of
the synagogue.
Okay, but fine. But it was also, it was always had to do after school time or before school time, mm-hmm. but not during school time.
Okay. How old, though, is that general idea of having choruses in synagogues?
In synagogues?
In conservative synagogues. How old is that, do you think?
Well, there's two types. The professional choir.
Well, I don't mean that.
Okay.
But I mean for young people's
okay.
choirs. Yeah.
You talk about children or are you talking
young
about?
Young people's chorus, you know, that idea. Is how old is
I
that?
Don't think it's very, matter of fact, I don't think it's, if you're talking about kids getting together and singing, you know, in a non quote sophisticated manner, I guess it goes back. Again, I can't tell you. I just started. I started in '61, and when I started, there were very little. There were hardly any I know of.
Because I've heard of people saying one way of training them before bar mitzvah is you go through the service with a group of people.
But that's different. That's not a choir. You see,
right.
You get a group of people.
I mean, sorry, something like teaching them the service.
Yeah, but you teach them in mass. But you're not teaching them. You're not teaching them to perform as a choral, a group. See, my philosophy was, and it still is, that you could take, for instance, you could take kids. And by the way, I have an article about this in the Journal of Synagogue Music.
Right.
I think it was 1977 or January issue. But anyways, you could take kids and teach them music of a greater complexity than is normally accepted.
No, I understand.
Okay.
That, yeah.
And so long as, and whatever text your music is, because whenever I commissioned a work, the text that I used had the ulterior motive of educating.
Okay.
For instance, I'll get later on, this is not so much, okay, I'm still in Akron. The second year after Shirati Tideinu, I wanted the kids to have a feeling of the Holocaust. So I commissioned Sam Rosenbaum and Charlie Davidson to take the old Yiddish songs, and they transcribed them. Sam wrote an English text, and Charlie arranged Yiddish folk songs. And the work was called The Singing of Angels. And it dealt with the songs that the kids sang in the shtetl prior to the Holocaust. And a text was composed around that, which brought the Holocaust to focus. So, and my concept of this, this is how I would teach the kids the Holocaust, as opposed to as the formal way of education, which led to the confrontations of sitting down in a class and saying, now today we are going to study the Holocaust. In 1939, and up until so-and-so, 6 million Jews perished. And we'll show you some films, as gruesome as they are, but you'll sit there and you'll look at them. Okay, so the kids look at them and yuck, you know, and they get all kinds. But it meant nothing, as when I said to them, this song was sung by kids your age who perished in the concentration camp. And I get later on even deeper. When I worked on a work called I Never Saw Another Butterfly. Okay? They were singing songs written by kids who wrote those poems one day, and the next day they were killed. Okay? And that to them, because they were singing their words.
Now, let me ask you this. I mean, why did, outside of the fact that you, the general notion of choruses, why do that in arranged versions with piano accompaniments rather than having them sing the songs the way kids would have just playing? I mean...
Okay, two reasons. One is that's because that was the way I preferred it. Because I wanted to... Because my whole object at that time, and it's my personality, to take things above the level of the ordinary, okay? Because there was nothing like it. In the entire, matter of fact, I can go back the entire history of Jewish music in America, okay? Never was there a concept of a children's choir of this kind.
Right.
A quasi, a Vienna boys choir, or a Princeton boys choir, or something like that.
No, I understand that. I was just
No, it was, because I did it better.
Yeah.
Because I personally was able to do that better. I was not the kind of person who could sit down at a piano and say, let's sing some Liedlach, some songs. That wasn't my thing. My thing, I'm not saying it couldn't be done that way. My whole approach was fine. You can teach me, it doesn't matter what level.
Yeah.
I mean, like I tell people here, you don't have to reach this level. You could do it at a primary level. If the kids get something, you know, if the end is the same thing, it doesn't matter.
Right, so that's what I'm asking. You're making an important educational point.
Exactly.
Which is, that's the way to teach, which I agree with you about. But then there's the question of the means of it.
It was the means in which I did the best.
Right.
It had nothing to do with the goal. The goal could have been, you know, you could reach that goal in many ways.
Yeah.
The way I reached that goal was, and by the way, and then I had other goals besides that. Let me finish Akron.
Yeah, sure. All right,
so I left Akron in 1969. Commissioned four works there, The Singing of Angels. Then I did the first Shabbat morning service, Koch Revoker by Max Wahlberg. And then in 1968 and 69, I did the Proverb Canticles, work on a Mishle, which is Proverbs, by Yisachar Maron. And then it was the first time I used an orchestral ensemble. Then I left Akron in 69 and I went to Dayton, okay? And I took a little hiatus from working with kids, but I still commissioned works for adult choir, utilizing college groups, the Miami University Choir, in which we did a work, Praises by Charles Davidson.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1973 started a string of creativity, which I think in this area is definitely unique. In 1973, in honor of Israel's 25th anniversary, I commissioned a work called Hallel, Psalms of Israel by Yisachar Maron, who was an Israeli composer, already my choir, my children's choir in Dayton was getting to the point which it surpassed Akron, because I was getting more sophisticated, and the complexity of the work was much more difficult than what I had done in Akron. And then in 1973, I took the very first children's choir, synagogue children's choir ever, to Israel as part of a concert tour in honor of Israel's 25th anniversary. And then starting in 1973, I did the Hallel. In 74, we commissioned again Nisachem Aron, who wrote a Shabbat morning service for us. I had commissioned Shalom Secunda to do it, but that was the year he became ill. As a matter of fact, he died shortly afterwards. So, and I was, matter of fact, I was in a lurch. I had nobody, so I called up my friend Miron, I saw her, and he wrote a Shabbat morning service. Then in 1975, I commissioned three works to depict, again, all that for educational purposes, to depict three different eras in Jewish music. Mm-hmm. The Baroque, in which Charlie Davidson wrote a Baroque suite, utilizing words by Yehuda Alevi in Baroque forms. Quasi Rossi, but not Rossi. It was beautiful. And then Samuel Bugach wrote seven Yiddish, original Yiddish songs, the first time choir, so the kids would know what Yiddish was. And by that way, also the concept of the shtetl was taught, and the whole idea of what Jewish life was in the shtetl. And then the contrast, all three, Shalom Caleb arranged for us a work in the Hasidic medley, taking Hasidic nigunim and developing, called Rejoice and Sing. The music is published, the recording is out, and it was so it was called Three Eras in Jewish Music, three major works, and the festival, then it was all part of the Dayton of our Beth Abraham Festival of Jewish Music, and it got to the point, it was and is a highlight in the cultural Dayton musical calendar, not just Jewish, because in the greatest, I guess, the accolade that every one of these concerts by these kids, because they were at this point now, this is 1975, at an incredibly high level. Mm-hmm. I already had 90 kids in the choir. Wow. Okay, yeah. And it got to the point where I broke it up into different groups, like the Baroque work was done by a chamber choir. At this time, actually, it was really expanding from what I had in Akron. I had four choirs. At this time, I had the full choir, 90 voices. Then I had a tour choir, because we started touring in 73, of 45 voices. Okay, then I had the Shabbat morning choir, which I had the alternate, the chamber choir made up the nucleus. And then I would take, because of the BEMA, and then I would take 15 kids each month from the regular choir, who officiated with me at the services. Uh-huh. So it was not just it got out of the realm of being just a performing choir. Yeah. It became a synagogue choir. Uh-huh. But to the point that it's very hard to conceive, because these kids, I taught them not to just to use the written musical compositions, but they improvised with me, which was an art which was practically completely lost.
That's amazing.
I was able to sing, and we demonstrated here at the convention, and they were able to follow without any preparation whatsoever. Yeah. I would start something, and they would hit a chord, and I would be able to modulate, and they would give me word responses, which was...
Well, look, that's what the old chazanim did. That's
right.
Exactly. You're just recreating the atmosphere of...
If you came to my shul on a Shabbos or on a high holidays, you would think you were back in Odessa, or
that's
whatever.
With the choir,
right, exactly. And that's exactly what it was. But this is totally unheard of in America, especially using American kids.
Right.
And a concept of that, you know.
Yeah.
And then I had the chamber choir, and I had the full choir, and I had the Shabbat choir, and the tour choir. So I had four choirs within the realm of one. Okay? And it was really taking off. It was really mushrooming. And then in 1976, we really did something which I thought is really incredible. I commissioned from Shalom Caleb the entire Yomi Nerayim service, starting from Slicha through Nila.
My God.
Okay? With Jack Barkin, cantor Jack Barkin is the soloist. And already we were using full orchestra. I'm telling you, came to our concerts, and I can give you a quote after this performance from the Dayton music, from the music critic, who was a fine, as a matter of fact, she used to be the vice president of music critics in America, that called a monumental work of Jewish music that should be heard by Gentile as well. I mean, it crossed the bounds. Concerts, and because these were events that were sold out weeks and even months in advance, And again, and this was all through kids. It was ordinary kids from a shul in Dayton, Ohio, which is not New York or Chicago or Cleveland. This is Dayton, a dorf. And again, when I gave papers, it just goes to show kids are kids. Yeah. And I didn't have the luxury of selecting one from this community, one from that community, and basically anybody who came. I was a strict disciplinarian, but with great love. I mean, these kids, I mean, in the rehearsal, you came to a rehearsal of mine, it started at 12 o'clock. If you weren't there, the doors were closed, and you didn't walk in unless you had an excuse, I mean, unless you called up before that you're going to be late, fine. Otherwise, that door was locked, and God himself wouldn't come in. That was it. And a rehearsal started at 12 o'clock, and these kids already, at this time, I didn't need them for school time. They came after Sunday school, and they gave their Sundays to me. Their Sundays belonged to me. They were there from 12 o'clock, and depending which group, if you were in a chamber choir who met afterwards, you were there until 3 o'clock every single Sunday. I had kids who gave the Bengals, you know, Cincinnati Bengals season tickets in order to be in a choir because you couldn't do both. Right. That was the degree that they reached at this point. Because it was quiet, and it was the largest youth organization in the city. Yeah. To become a member of the Beth Abram Youth Chorale was like making first string basketball team in high school, because I made it that way. Yeah. So when you talk about education, I'm coming back to this again. Yeah. It was my approach that I had to have all of this aura of perfection, in order to make it so that when the kids got into this group, it was an honor. And then when you got in it, then baby, then you were in my hands.
Right.
And then there was nothing. I mean, your souls belong to me. You understand? Because I'm confident if I get you in a room, or talking about if I get a group of kids in a room, once I get you, that's it.
Now, how much did this then spread? I mean, how many of these comparable things are there?
Nothing. And that, I'll go on later on. This is one of the great frustrations of my life.
Uh-huh.
One of the great, now, if you don't mind, let me just finish what I
did. Sure.
Okay, so in 76, we commissioned for the first time a complete High Holy Day service in the traditional vein.
Mm-hmm.
I told Shalom Caleb, I want this to have the dignity of Odessa with the nostalgia of Rivington Street. And that's exactly what he gave me. Starting from Slichas, Exodus from Rosh Hashanah, Kol Nidre, and Nila. It was a 350-page manuscript. And by the way, every work that these kids did was totally by memory at the performance.
Incredible.
Never sang with a piece of music.
That's amazing.
I mean, the score was this 350 pages. And for the first time that year on the High Holidays, which is also a first in the history, I think, of anywhere, I had 76 kids on the bima. Can you imagine that in a shul? 76 kids without a piece of paper in front of them except for the machzor.
Yeah.
So when I talk about education,
that's outrageous.
When these kids came in Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, their entire lives, and I told them, I said, and the reason I wanted the traditional music, went later on, you know, if you go on, whatever you want, if you want to hear modern concepts, fine, I'm all for it. But I want you to have that tradition. So when you're Olenu, you know, I mean, that's the way Olenu is sung. If somebody else wants to compose it differently, it's in your ears. That's the way it should be done. And they stood on the beam with me from the time of Musaf, from 10 o'clock when they blew the shofar, to 1 o'clock. Of course, nobody left because there was no room they can get off. Of course, the congregation at first didn't accept this very well because they walked and they saw this massive kids up there. And they didn't know, is this a concert or is this a service? And that whole problem, and I tried my very best to make this, that's why I didn't want them using music, and that's why I had them leading in the congregational singing. And I tried to make it as unconspicuous as possible. It was impossible because you got to, as a matter of fact, the congregation, because at that time, you know, by this time already, I really had control of the situation. They even took out two rows of the shul, you know, in order to extend the bima. I mean, and, you know, and giving up two rows on Rosh Hashanah, I know that's no small thing. But for 1976, the thing I was most proud of, okay, they sang these musical compositions, but they were able to improvise with me.
Amazing.
I would start Hineni, and these kids would give me a chord which would blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm an improviser.
Uh-huh.
Except when it sounds like I'm an improviser. Yeah. I believe in a note that has to come from the heart.
Yeah.
And although I study compositions, when I get up there, it has to be Jerry Kotmar. And that's what I feel. And so, they just never know. They could be sitting there, and all of a sudden, I'll just look up them and I'll say, something's coming. Could be in the middle of service. And they're right there. and no questions, I mean, no hesitation, nothing. Okay, that was 1976. In 1977, I commissioned Charlie Davis to write a work on the Book of Ruth. And the kids learned the Book of Ruth through this way. They learned, and I went even a little step further. The rabbi, once a month, when the kids used to daven on Shabbos, we would have a luncheon for the choir and their parents, and he would teach the Book of Ruth. To bring this whole thing into an educational focus. 1978, my idea was to compose all the services. 1978, Caleb wrote for us the entire Shabbos, from Friday night through Havdalah, a work even larger than the Days of Awe, which Cantor Moshe Taubi did the solo. Again, with full orchestra, but also with the idea that it has to be able to be performed a cappella, because in the service we did a cappella, the concerts, whatever. And again, I must point out at this time we were touring throughout the country. We toured every major, I think, every major center in America, from Miami to New York to Boston to Cleveland to Toronto to Los Angeles. And again, this is Dayton, Ohio. This is not, and our repertoire was just, and everything was by us was commissioned, either commissioned for us or arranged for us, because there was no music. Why did I get in the commissioning business in the beginning? Because before 1966, when I did Charlotte, there was nothing for kids. There was adaptations. They would take Lewandowski and write two part and this, but something especially for kids, you know, except for one line or, you know, one, there was nothing written. There was nothing. And there was no repertoire, so I created a repertoire. I created a repertoire. And in 1979, Morton Gold wrote for us a great experience for the kids. Was the Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, in English. Took works from each chapter in an oratorial style. A massive work. It took an hour and a half to perform. And I had the Abe Mizrahi and a soprano soloist, again with full orchestra. Again, totally by memory. Uh-huh. But these kids were quoting Pirkei Avot. These kids were quoting Pirkei Avot. In 1980, I had Abraham Kaplan, the great choral conductor and composer. He wrote for us the Book of Psalms, selections from Psalms. In 1981, I finished the trilogy. The Days of Joy. It was the Days of Awe, the Days of Rest, the Day of Rest, and now the Days of Joy. Mm-hmm. Caleb didn't want to write the final work, so Morton Gold wrote, this was the festivals. So I had the entire liturgy.
Right, the whole thing, yeah.
Again, and it wasn't only for concert. These kids utilized this in the shul.
Amazing.
Okay? And then in 1982, it was probably one of our greatest moments. It was our 10th anniversary. And Jan Pierce was our soloist. Mm. And here's, because this is an incredible story, and I want to get this documented because this is historical. This was 1982, the great, great, great Jan Pierce. Although he was 78 years old at that time, we were supposed to make a record. I said, I'll make the record with you, provided you come and sing at our music festival for the 10th anniversary. And he did. And we spent four of the greatest days of my life with this man. Stayed at our house, and him and his wife, and talking to all hours of the night on his experiences, and it was very, very interesting. When I announced to the kids at Jan, I had 96 kids or something like this. I announced Jan Pierce is going to be our guest soloist, and I had the reaction of this thing going. Not one kid knew him. So I said, so it was a big deal. If I had, Michael Jackson, I would have had a great hurrah. So you go home and tell your parents that Jan Pierce is singing with you. So, of course, they went home and they couldn't, Jan Pierce, you know. So the kids came back the following Sunday. Wow, my mother showed me his records, you know, this and that. So all of a sudden, it was a great excitement. So I said, yes. I said, Jan Pierce, one of the greatest singers of our time, is going to be singing with you at the 10th anniversary. And we commissioned a whole bunch of stuff in honor of that called Moods and Celebration. Works that included him and some works that didn't include him. I could tell you some a very interesting experience if you're interested in this. I know this is for historical, but it's a little sidelight. When he came in for rehearsal, of course, he treated these kids like they were the New York Philharmonic. I mean, they were pros. I mean, you weren't kids to him. At first, he didn't want to sing with them. I had to bring tapes to show that, you know, you're not just singing with a bunch of... When he heard them, he said, this is America? I mean, these kids, I said, yes. I said, I'm not asking you to sing with a bunch of kids, you know, just kids. So he was extremely impressed. He said, with these kids, I'll sing. So when he came for the first rehearsal, of course, these kids were pros. I mean, I taught them to have in their mind that they're pros. I said, my whole philosophy was, I said, if you want to be treated like kids, so I'll treat you like kids. If you want to be treated like pros, you'll be like pros.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I said, and as a result, I know pros don't get complimented all the time, and people don't go, I mean, but little kids do. He patted my head and said, he's saying beautifully, saying nice. I said, but you're pros. So when he came to the first rehearsal, he wanted certain things in his way, you know, and the kids took immediate insult.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, I found out later, it wasn't so much that he was telling them what to do, but in their mind, he was contracting me.
Oh, right.
And I was, and no one, no one,
and you
but,
were God, right.
Right, and no one, but no one.
Yeah.
I mean, if I know, if I said I wanted soft, fine, but who the hell is he to say he wants it soft? I don't
uh-huh.
care who he is.
Uh-huh.
You know, the fact that if you mention he's Toscanini's favorite tenor, who's Toscanini? I mean,
right.
It meant nothing to them.
Right.
But when he got around, he started yelling at them, you know, and they're, you know, I know this. He was loving off the stage. When he got on the stage, he was Jan Pierce.
Right.
And of course, it was a great lesson because everything that he told them, I had already told them beforehand, but, you know, it didn't register. So they were very disturbed with him. They hated him. So I use this as a learning lesson also. So the Sunday of the concert, before Pierce came in for the final get-together, and in fact, I told him to come a half hour late, I sat these kids down. And I tell them, you know, there comes a time in life when you got to realize there's always somebody better and bigger and more important than you are. I said, I found out over the last few days the reason why you're so angry with Mr. Pierce. And I said, I'm really flattered. And I'm really touched. I said, I had never been so touched in my whole life because you were looking out for me. I said, but I'm telling you, if Mr. Pierce told me to go up on the roof, I would go up on the roof. I said, you got to understand, when I was 6 years old, it was this man that gave me my first inkling to what Jewish music was all about. I said, when I heard his Kol Nidre, that was my first memory of what I was 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah.
And it remains, I remember sitting in my grandfather's house in Montreal, and he had that record, and I put it on, and I kept on playing it and playing it and playing it. I said, and all of us, and I'm conducting Jan Pierce. I said, can you imagine what this is in my life? I said, you know, from your perspective, it's a different story.
Yeah.
I said, he's sang at every major opera house in the world. I said,
right.
With every major
right.
conductor. And I said, here he is in Dayton, Ohio, and I'm going to conduct Jan Pierce. I said, you realize the trepidation I have in my heart? And I said, I want you to know. He said, he's just a pro as you are. I said, you know, there's not a thing. I said, you want to know? I said, we sat down. I said, there's not a thing in which I suggested to him musically in which he didn't accept.
Mm-hmm.
If I said, Mr. Pierce, I called him Jan, of course, let's sing this softer, let's sing this louder, everything, fine. I said, but there's certain things which he demands. He says, when he wants you to sing softer, when he's singing, it's because he can't, he said, you're 93 compared to one.
Right. So you basically taught them that.
Taught them
that,
about testing humility. But anyways, let me tell you, it was that concert that night, next to 1966, that one I told you about, was the grandest moment of my life. Because number one, these kids were, I'm going to give you, by the way, I'll give you before you leave as a gift, the recording.
Great.
Okay. But what happened, and Pierce was absolutely incredible at 78 years old. And the last thing he sang was a work that we commissioned from Shalom Kim called Modim, which is a prayer of thankfulness, in which there's a text in there, Achayenu hamesurim biyadacha, our lives we put in your hands, and our souls we put in your care. And this man sang with this, I mean, it was like the Jan Pierce of 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And after the concert, and I have this on tape, if you don't believe me, I'll make you a copy of it. He said, I sang with Toscanini for 8 to 15 years, whatever it was, at the Metropolitan for 28 years. But he says, but I tell you, this is one of the finest moments of my entire career.
Mm.
He said, these kids are not kids. These are pros. And he went on, and it was, and 4 days later, he had a stroke and has never sung since.
Right.
That was his last performance. That was his last recording. And we have it out. You'll hear part of it. I'll get you. I'm going to give you a copy of that.
Great.
It was his last performance. So, I mean, the whole idea that you're Jerry Kotmar, that after Toscanini and whoever he was, I was his last conductor.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Okay, so it's something that just boggles my mind.
Sure.
So in 1983, I didn't commission the work, and then I took a sabbatical. Mm-hmm. I took a sabbatical for many reasons, and this is everything I've told you was, I guess, I think it's very special. Whether you do or not, I don't know. I became disillusioned with it, the whole approach. The kids became, after this was already 14 years, for me personally, I was burnt out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, sure, you can't do that kind of high-intensity thing forever.
I was burnt out.
Yeah.
What do I do next? Another commission? I already had 25.
Yeah.
Another world premiere? I've already had, I mean, more than anybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, if the assembly goes on for another 100 years, I don't think anyone's going to reach that record of commissioning. I mean, it's just, I mean, that's documented. You could have it. Another tour. I take to the kids, we're going to Florida. But we were there last year. I mean, we're going here. I mean, there was no place. I mean,
right.
Everything was already to the point.
Right.
What do you do next? I had to have a break. Also, in the congregation, it became not something special, but became ordinary.
Right, it was just like, oh, yeah. Right.
I mean, everybody doesn't have this.
Right.
You mean it?
That's the trouble with things like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I had no regrets because my greatest reward are those kids already married now, and they have kids, and they come back, and they say the greatest experiences of my youth were the choir. I never forget this. I mean, what it taught me religiously and what it taught me, educationally wise. I said, and when I get letters from kids in college, it doesn't prove my point about education. I cannot sit in the service on the high holidays without remembering, and their whole idea of they heard a chazanisha davening, and it's in their ears through me. These kids are trained. Now that they have to go into a community, they do, because they're married now. If there's a synagogue choir, these kids will be right in the
sure.
And the camp.
Yeah, so you brought up a whole.
A generation, a continued generation, and that was pretty much that. So whether I go back to it or not, I don't know. I mm-hmm. think I made my. Now I'm doing things for myself. I'm singing now. I'm doing a lot of concerts on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I come to New York and I study once a month now. Mm-hmm. All the things I put in.
Yeah.
I put in on the back burner for these years, and I'm taking up front, and I'm very happy in that sense.
Question is, if this didn't get picked up on,
okay, that's,
why didn't it get picked up?
Okay.
It sounds like a great idea.
Okay, now I mean, you brought up a marvelous point, and I've asked this question, and I have my own answers.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Number one, going back to what I told you before. With the rabbis and educators, etc.
Yeah.
They didn't want this. They don't want this. I was able to do it because I think of my own personality.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think they wanted this because I think it was too much of a showpiece.
And it's threatening, and right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, how many rabbis? Luckily, I was able to want 60 kids on a Bima Rosh Hashanah. Okay, not even 60. You have 10 or 20. But not only. But kids who sing.
Right. So it was threatening.
It was a very threatening thing.
Yeah.
And number two, I blame it on the chazan themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Laziness.
Well, it's in Texas, particular talent.
Okay, I'm going to that.
Yeah.
There's a sense of laziness in the sense that I don't want to get involved with that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's a talent. Like I told you before, I think I have a charisma. Somebody else I know, some of my colleagues here, they have 150 Torah readers in their show, which is incredible. I couldn't do that if I stood on my head.
Right.
It's just not my thing.
That's
okay,
right. Yeah.
There's some other guys who have bar mitzvah programs. Of course, I don't have to teach bar mitzvahs. They have bar mitzvah programs, which are really something very special.
Yeah.
And again, and the means are the same. They're educating their kids. Great, fantastic. I don't care how you do it. You know, everyone has their own means. But I think it came down to that, and I think, although I tell you, and this is something very interesting, and I see this now, in those communities that we visited, we never left them the same.
Mm-hmm.
I have guys here tell me, he said, I was trying to have a children's choir, always. I mean, not always, not to your level. No, that's okay. I don't have to. I told you in the beginning, it doesn't have to be my level.
Yeah.
Okay. He says, when you left, he said, it was, once you gave that concert, everybody, they demanded it from me that I have it. And He said, I have one now. Not your level. I was speaking to someone yesterday from Stamford, Connecticut. And we were there twice. He has a voice, children's choir, 40 voices now. Mm-hmm. I have a woman came over to me yesterday. He says, I want to tell you something. I said, with your kids and with your papers and talking, he said, I have a children's choir now. I have another guy here, David Tillman, is conducting tomorrow. He teaches at the seminary. He says, we use your, I wrote a paper. He says, we use that paper as a text. Mm-hmm. Okay? I said, and it's also a text. He said, matter of fact, he brought up a kid of 60 voices last year or something. And before that, he acknowledged, he says, I want you to know this is due to what Jerry Kottmar has inspired. Or,
yeah.
Okay? So, it is. Of course, my dream was always, and I had this dream behind, and you know, I don't think it'll be realized, certainly won't be realized by me, maybe 20 years ago, if I can go back and put all my energies into this, as I did into the choir, and that's to form a national society of synagogue youth choirs,
sure, right.
Based on the U.S. wise and that kind of stuff, and
yeah.
Which would be a central office in which music would be disseminated and distributed, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, and to have
yeah,
a,
right.
And
National Festival.
Right, and I even had an idea, I had a dream, and in fact, I was beginning to really work on it, but I just didn't have it, to have a camp, quasi camp Rama.
Now, why can't you work with Rama and build out?
Very interesting.
This is something I'm asking everybody. Everybody complains about Rama, but it seems that nobody works with him.
They're not interested. They're not interested. Matter of fact, Camp Rama is doing more, in my estimation, doing their share to destroy. Traditional Chazonic values than I think any one institution, because what happens, these kids go there, and I don't think there's one Rama that has a cantor on staff. I don't know if that's true or not, but I
is
think...
Is this because the cantors don't volunteer, or
no,
because the Rama doesn't want
it? They don't want it.
They really don't want it.
They don't want it. Okay. They want the image, and which is happening, by the way, in these congregations are becoming little microcosms, they're becoming little mirrors of Ramas, in which or camp Ramas, in which you have to sing the camp Rama type camp songs for.
Yeah.
They're becoming the congregational singing, and when kids come back and say, "But will you do it at Rama this way?" I
right.
say, "Yeah, but the way you do Rama is not necessarily the right way." I mean, they're not taught. This is the way you did a Nusach on Shabbos. This is the way
yeah,
you do.
Yeah, I understand
it.
That. So, but see, some people said to me, "Well, maybe we never made the attempt to go and,
well,
and infiltrate them." You know?
I think you're right, but I know there have been cases where they were turned down and they weren't interested.
Yeah.
But I would, matter of fact, in order for what my dream would have been, it'd have to be completely divorced
yeah.
from the Rama influence. In other words, it would have to be completely controlled. My idea of the camp of a camp would be to have your great teachers of Jewish music giving lectures and
yeah.
teaching kids, and every Shabbat have a different great chazan come in and do the service, and you know it's and really
yeah.
to me develop that would develop a and to have of course the different kinds of the choirs. I mean not only synagogue music but the Yiddish music and Hebrew music and
yeah.
But of course on a perhaps different levels, but to also have that real. The real elite level.
Right. So you think it's not just not possible with that? I mean, it seems to me.
No, I think it is possible.
Very odd to have this inbuilt conflict between two branches of the same enterprise.
We've had that conflict, of, I mean, and you're going to see in your studies, going back to the history of. I mean, I have a book. I've read many books, as many as there are, that. The cantors had conflicts from the beginning of time. I mean, it's always.
Yeah, but I mean, this is within the conservative movement.
Yeah, okay, but
I mean,
don't forget, it's all a matter of. What is important, like to us, to me personally,
mm-hmm.
Nusach is one of the most vital, important aspects
right.
of synagogue life. I mean, it kept us together.
Right.
Okay, but to most people, they could care less. I mean, and if what's happening, it's even infiltrating in the Canada Assembly amongst your younger members. They feel that it's fine to sing to sing some of these melodies which aren't necessarily of the Nusach or aren't necessarily of a traditional nature. You know, maybe that's the way it's going. I don't. Maybe that's the way it should be. I don't know. I have no idea. This is for historians to find out. But to me, it's wrong. To me, it's absolutely wrong. And I think if I proved one thing, I think I proved one thing with these kids, and this is one lesson which I talked about over and over and over and over again. I said it's just as easy to teach these kids. Sophisticated
yeah.
elements and sophisticated and traditional way of doing things and teaching them to love it as the other way. I can tell you, I'll give you one little interesting story. The last the last year, in the year we had Pierce, we did a work called Chazak Chazak, recommissioned from Ralph Schlossberg, and he wrote it in a rock, with a rock beat, with a rock band and everything else. And I thought these kids would love it. So in the first rehearsal when I had it, I had the pianist play the thing, and they looked at me, "We're not singing that garbage."
You succeeded too well.
No, I said, I said, I have four kids. This is the stuff you listen to all the time. Yeah, this stuff is very good, but not for choir. No, it's choir was a different story. You know, outside we'll sing anything we want, but choir, there's a certain element, there's a certain level.
Yeah.
And I was stunned. I was literally stunned out of my, you know, in choir we don't sing this stuff. Okay, they ended up singing it because I taught them this is music as well, et cetera, et cetera, and you know, and they did a beautiful job with it. But the point is that they were taught. So it's my whole premise is that kids can be taught. They can be taught to appreciate just as easy. You could put a piece of cake on this side and a piece of cake. And that's my approach.
Yeah.
So my dream would have been to have a camp, a National Association of Synagogue Choirs, with a governing board of people who really understand.
Do you think this is possible?
I definitely think it's possible if somebody's willing to do it. If somebody's willing to really take the ball.
Sounds like you'd be the person.
Well, if I didn't have a job in Dayton, Ohio, and if I wasn't a chazan, and someone said to me, whoever would have said, "Look, we want to start this thing. Yeah. We're giving you X amount of dollars. Will you do it?"
You'd have it within
and you would have
minutes,
it.
Right.
You'll have it. There's no question about it. You'll have it. And that is the way the whole tradition of Jewish music would change. Because you would get, my estimate, you would get these kids. First of all, these kids would be imbued with a love for it. And it would be a natural feeding ground to the Candidates Institute. Because who feeds the rabbinical schools? Your Camp Ramah kids. Okay?
But why is it that you were against Ramah music, but you weren't against the rock-based service?
And it wasn't a service. It was just one piece, Chazak, Chazak.
Yeah, but I mean, that's...
Okay, look, if you
have... That's bringing something that's even more foreign than Ramah.
Okay, no, very interesting. You ask a good question, because if you are doing... If you have in your repertoire 50 pieces of the of classic element, whatever it is, and you have one piece, okay, it's just one piece.
Yeah.
If you had 49 of this and one piece of the other, it's a different story. It was a curiosity sort of thing, it was in honor of a 10th anniversary. The text itself, Chazak Chazak, we need Chazek, to strengthen ourselves, and he just happened to want to write it that way. When he told me he wants to write it in rock, at first I said, I'm not sure. He says, look, let's give it a try. Okay, do it. Okay, it was never to be done in services at synagogue. It was strictly a concert piece, and for concert pieces, I could, you know, there's a difference between kodesh and chol, between what's holy and which is ordinary.
Yeah.
For what I do, what we do at a concert, is not what we would do at a service.
Right.
I would never allow it in a service. I would never even think of something of that nature in a service.
Yeah.
To me, it wasn't really a compromise. I didn't feel like, because it was just like doing another form, a different piece of music. But to me, the whole answer, I still think, is in kids. I still think, I think the cantoret is dying. The cantoret as I know it and love it and feel it should be. I think the congregations are not being taught to appreciate what good chazanot is. I mean, in my congregation, and again, this is in Dayton, Ohio, and on Shabbos morning, I have a congregation of about 150 people, that if I don't sing a cantorial recitative, they'll come to me and say, "You're not feeling well today. You must not feel it." Because they know, just as there's a sermon every week, there is a cantorial recitative. I mean, and even if I'm ill, I will do it, not perhaps in the grand manner that I would do if I was healthy. I would do it in a more subdued, but they would know that there is a chazanic piece every single week. And they look forward to it. So to me, it's a matter of education.
Yeah.
It's a matter of training.
Well, I must say, everybody I've talked to so far has been involved in some aspect of doing that. I don't think it's quite so bad as everybody seems to think. Maybe I'm only talking to the right people.
Well, that could be awesome.
That's
marvelous. Because I just tell you from my experience, and I know... Because in touring with the choir, I've just got to see synagogues which ordinary people wouldn't, or cantors wouldn't get to see.
Yeah.
And I saw the frustration on these on cantors and say, I haven't been able to do a cantorial piece in 10 years or 5 years.
Well, I mean different ways of educating the membership to appreciate.
I'm speaking from my point of view, and again, the whole thing comes down to what kids
yeah.
can do and were able to do. And right. I think if you know, if I don't ever start this enterprise again, I think it proved one thing, that kids could be taught to perform in a level
right.
Which is unexpected.
Well, that's a great contribution.